language carries values, it carries history, it carries culture. So in the task of data set creation, I think I would say it's much better to talk to writers or archaeologists or anthropologists and use language to document stories of our people versus taking texts written in a different language and then translating them into, say, Kiswahili, because we're looking to create Kiswahili texts. And it's the same way we should think critically about the development of AI technologies.
Welcome to World Beat. I am George Collins. I hope all you good folks out there are doing well wherever and whenever you happen to be tuning in. Now, computers have taken over the world, as my old high school teacher once said, and indeed this here podcast wouldn't be possible without them. And as we become more conscious of their role in our lives, as the new group of technologies collectively sitting under this digital label pull greater scrutiny of their impact on our everyday interactions. Now, we here in North America and Europe talk about these effects of social media while flexing on suburban white kids and our coworkers at the water cooler, things like that. But we don't always talk about the effects on kids and people in middle and lower income parts of the world. In fact, the Indian author Amitav Ghosh once wrote of these Syrian refugee children who genuinely believe they would be safe in these rickety boats across the Mediterranean so long as their phones were charged. Now, on a macro level, the digital space has set new stages for economic development, especially on the African continent, which has long time served as a laboratory for global development policies for decades. Computerization and our guest today's specialty, machine learning, are going to play pivotal roles in the next century of societal change across Africa and much of the world. And questions of whom that technology serves and who owns the digital space are going to be pivotal in ensuring equitable access. So that's a lot to unpack, but I'm really excited to have this guest with us, who I think is a great person to help us with that. Joining me on World Beat is Kathleen Semenyu. Ms. Semenyu is an AI researcher who focuses on natural language processing for African languages. She works at the Mozilla Foundation as a machine learning fellow, and prior to that was the regional coordinator of AI4D Africa. She has vast experience as a community organizer, having co-organized the Nairobi Women in Machine Learning and Data Science community for 3 years, work that she continues in to this day. Ms. Semenyu, thank you so much for joining us on World Beat.
And thank you for having me, George.
Of course. So before we begin with these issues, we'd like to get a bit of an idea of your background. As someone who was born and raised in Kenya, what was the state of the country at the time, and what was it like growing up in such an environment?
So I'll say this is probably my best question to answer, because then I get to really just talk about myself. My parents are doctors, and so for a long time growing up, I thought I would become a doctor. The sciences were very much emphasized in our home. And up until I was 16 years old, I was set on this path. At 16, I needed to do community service and decided that the best place to do it is at a hospital so that I could get, you know, hands-on experience in this medical field in some way. And this is the point at which I realized that I couldn't become a doctor because, I really just couldn't stomach watching people suffer and show up every single day, to do it again and again. And so I started exploring what else. And at 16, I'm very close to the end of high school, which is the point at which we make decisions about what to go study in uni. So it felt very time sensitive that I figure out exactly what happens next. And I'll say, being a very logical person, I sat down and decided, okay, what am I good at? And what are these subjects prerequisites for at university level? And really, that's how I ended up studying math and computer science in uni. because among my best performing subjects were physics and math. And in Kenya, with the education system, you get to pick, I think, your top three courses that you'd like to do at the university. So I figured that with math and physics, I could get into computer science. I think at that point, The Social Network, which is the movie about Mark Zuckerberg's journey to founding Facebook, was pretty huge at the time. It had just come out. And so I Googled, what's this programming computer science thing? And I watched the movie and I was like, yeah, I think this is what I want to do. So I happened to get my first course choice and went to uni to study math and computer science. The math was very difficult. I actually regretted doing a dual major as opposed to just taking computer science, but I made it through. I very much enjoyed the programming. And in uni at the time, the ecosystem was, and I think still very much is, supported by developer communities. So organizations like Google, Microsoft have support at university level for developer communities. And that, to be honest, is really how I learned how to code and how most people in my university actually learn how to code, because what we do in class versus what is required in the workplace is very different. And my course was actually very theoretical. I remember having to do exams where we'd be asked to, you know, write a Java program or with pen and paper, and you're expected to like remember all the syntax and semantics of the language, and ensure that correctness. So developer communities are really how I started to actually write code. And I'll say this is actually how I even went into my first role. So I discovered data science close to my final year and decided, hey, this is interesting. I'd like to dig deeper into it. I did a couple of online courses, did a final year project. And then once I was done with school, I started attending data oriented meetups in Nairobi. And Nairobi has a pretty big tech ecosystem. I'll say it's highly evolved compared to other places in Africa, in that you'll find specialized communities. If you're interested in Python, if you're interested in Java or generally languages on the JVM, if you're interested in natural language processing or AI or data science, you can find specific communities for all these different things. At least pre-pandemic, things were very active. And that's essentially how I bumped into the people who gave me my first professional role. So in my first role, I worked as a data scientist at a company called Africa's Talking. And it's a company in the telco space. So our products, or their products, are SMS, USSD, voice. And as a person working on data, I worked in a whole spectrum of activities, starting with just ensuring that various business units in the organization have data relevant to their needs, going all the way to building a data infrastructure, to finally getting to doing some data science duties with our various products. But the nature of business is such that your priorities keep moving and shifting depending on what it is a business needs. So soon enough, I figured out that Africa's Talking is not where I wanted to be long term, because I discovered that I have a very keen interest in building for languages in particular. And I could do that for some of our products, but then I couldn't focus my entire time on that. And this was compounded by the fact that I had a team. And so my role now evolved to making sure that my team can perform, as opposed to being the person implementing some of the stuff that we need to do. So let me maybe go into the story of how I discovered that languages is super interesting. Having worked at Africa's Talking for a while, one of our products, as I've mentioned, was SMS or messaging. And in election years, Kenya has very tumultuous, chaotic election years, where typically splits along ethnic lines. And in my view, it's really realistically a split between the political class and the rest of us. But then the tool that the political class uses to control where power goes is that they divide the vote along tribal lines. So on every other year, we're just Kenyans. But then on election years, then it becomes, you know, very important that you remember that you're tribe X or tribe Y. And so in previous years, we'd had elections which turned violent because there was hate speech, there was inciting, and people were urged to pick up their weapons and go and fight. And so lives were lost. It was a whole mess. So in these elections, which I believe were the 2017 elections, what the communication authority in the country did was they mandated that if any hateful messages or insightful messages were sent on any telco's infrastructure, then they would get banned for the duration of the election period and I think probably get heavily fined. And so what telcos did was they passed on this responsibility to all their users. And us guys as a business user, because we are a company that's built on their infrastructure and we enable other companies to use their products. So aggregators, essentially, companies like us, that mandate was passed on to us to ensure that no harmful content is spread through our infrastructure. And then that then fell onto my desk as, you know, the data scientist at Africa Stocking. And in a meeting, I was asked, what can we do at a data level to ensure that we're doing everything we can to make sure we're not sending any insightful material? And I remember thinking to myself, oh, there should be a super nifty fix for this. Because if you think about English and what NLP tools exist, you could do sentiment analysis on text messages and to some extent start flagging and saying, okay, this message potentially has harmful or insightful or hateful material versus this one which does not. But then I began to quickly realize that if I wanted to replicate the same solution in Kiswahili, it was impossible. And let alone, you know, all the other 44 plus other languages which are spoken in this country. And those were the languages that matter in an election year when we're being divided along tribal lines, right? Because each ethnic group has its language. And so you're likely to spread hateful messages in those languages so that others are excluded. Long story short, I realized I really wanted to build tools for African languages, not because it would be anything novel, because if you think about it, if it can be done for English, then it's a solved problem. It can be done for other languages. I view it as a symptom or signal of who has been in the room, who has had the knowledge, the skills, the resources, and really the decision-making capacity to decide what languages we focus on versus which ones we don't. And it has repeatedly compounded that English has all these tools, or other major Western languages have all the tools and capabilities, and not so much the African ones. So at this point, I left industry and went into academia because I realized academia is this beautiful place where if you figure it out, you can get paid to just work on the problems that you want to work on. And I've been, I'll say, meddling in academia ever since. I have transitioned from industry and worked partly in the development space. So at my most previous role with AI4D, I worked with funders to ensure or to draw up programs that could mean funding goes to researchers and communities who are working in AI and ML in the space in Africa. So I've done a stint in the development funded world, and that's been interesting to view in contrast to industry, because then you start to realize where in the startup world, you being given money by an investor means they're going to want updates, or they're going to want to see the results. They'll want to see that you have implemented what you said you wanted to implement with the funding. And then realizing that the development space works vastly different. There was a lot of money, probably as much, maybe even more than in industry, but not as much due diligence or follow-up as in industry, in terms of, yes, you submitted a proposal, 6 months in, have you hit the milestones that you should have hit 1 year in or at the end of the project? Do you actually deliver what it is that you said you would deliver? Plus, I encountered the fact that in the development world, not spending money is a bad thing, because it means in the next annual budget or, you know, whatever timeline, you're likely to get less money, which of course you don't want. So it was interesting for me to encounter the fact that sometimes we needed to spend money in 2 months, and it really wasn't so much about what the money was spent on rather than that it was spent. And also realizing other dynamics, that impact in the industry can mean a very different thing from impact in the development world, and realizing that certain partners are, of course, interested in a story which appears more impactful than they are in other games. But I'll say it's just dynamics of the industry, of the different industries. I have also seen in this time the private industry or the startup ecosystem in Nairobi in particular, and let me say in Africa in general, grow, because 2015 to 2020, I'll say it was becoming exciting. We had startups, some of them were getting funded and were getting excited about funding. I remember in my years at Africa Stalking, we received funding, I think at a valuation of 8 million. And that was very exciting for the organization. And now if you look at the startup ecosystem in Africa in general, there's companies which are valued in the billions of dollars. So things have grown tremendously. And that's also been super interesting to watch. So to wind up this section where I speak about myself, I will also say that I've spent quite a bit of time supporting communities, tech communities in general. So again, my first real interaction with learning how to code in uni was through a developer community. At the time, I was an Intel student partner, and this meant that I needed to learn some skills and be able to host events where I'd teach other university students how to code with Intel tools. When I got my first job, I wasn't trained as a data scientist. I did have the prerequisites of math and computer science, but then I did need to do a lot of learning on the job. And again, I turned to communities because I realized that it's the way that I had learned. And so it's a thing that I knew. So I co-founded and co-organized the Nairobi Women in Machine Learning and Data Science community for 3 years. And this really helped me connect with individuals who, when I'm troubleshooting at work and hitting a dead end, I can actually call them up and be like, hey, what's happening here? It was also just great to network and know who else is in the ecosystem, what they're doing, and find out what other interesting companies in this space are working on exciting things. And then I've also connected with the Deep Learning in Durba, which is a regional organization in Africa working to strengthen machine learning. So we've got a number of programs, one of them, which is an annual event dubbed the Deep Learning in Durba, where we bring in students from across the continent to come and speak about their work and attend lectures and do practicals on a number of AI topics. So I've also really been in this space where I've been supporting communities and seeing that grow from a point of being focused on capacity building, because, you know, at one point, all the best universities that were teaching AI or ML skills were only based in certain parts of the world. But then again, with the passage of time, you find that there's more schools able to offer you master's or PhD, or to support you through master's and PhD courses on the continent. In addition to just there being more startups that you can work at, or more research opportunities and postdoc opportunities if you'd like to continue working on the continent.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Now, one of the subjects you've written on quite a bit, especially as it pertains to your journey through this whole thing, and you've touched on it, is the impact of language. And I've read pieces you've written where growing up, Kiswahili was something that would be learned like in the classroom, but maybe not always encouraged to be used outside of that, whether it be in everyday contexts and certainly in professional ones. And so throughout this journey that you just described, like what has been your relationship with Kiswahili and wanting to integrate that into your work, both from a young age all the way through your professional life?
Okay. So stepping back a bit, Kiswahili is a language that's spoken in Kenya, in Tanzania, very widely in East Africa in general. In Kenya, for example, it's a national language, which means that we use it just as much as we do English. But then to further expand on language use in this ecosystem or in this country, we also all have a mother tongue, right? So there are people whose mother tongue is Kiswahili, but then for many of us, we learn it as a second language or perhaps a third language. In my case, or perhaps a first language, actually, we could learn it as a first language, second language, or third language, but then it differs whether you are, whether it's your mother tongue, whether you're learning it as a second language, or whether you end up learning it because it's a national language in the country. But we all learn it, and it's very widely used in social settings. I think it's very interesting because in Kenya, at least in certain parts of Kenya, English is the default. And I don't think that's unique to Kenya. There's many places in Africa where whatever Western language is a national language is the default. And this is for social reasons, because it's viewed as a language that then gives you access to upward mobility, right? So what happened, for example, in the case of my younger brother, his first language was Kiswahili. And it's because being in the house, we'd have a help whose primary language was Kiswahili, right? And she would spend most of the time with him. So he was very proficient in Kiswahili as a child, as an infant. And then when he started going to kindergarten, then in school, they'd interact in English. And it was made a rule that actually in school, the only language you can speak is English, in a bid to get kids improving their English skills. Because once you start school, all the languages, all the subjects you learn are in English, except Kiswahili, which is you learn as a language, but it's the only thing that you learn in Kiswahili. So what happened with my brother is his Kiswahili skills actually regressed to a point where by the time he got into primary school, he really struggled with Kiswahili versus English. Because you see, in school, they were always, this thing was drummed into them that actually only speak English. And if you spoke Kiswahili, you would then be punished. And I think it's the case in very many other places in Africa as well, where we prioritize this language, again, because of the upward mobility. But then the way in which it happens is at very different stages and can be subtle or unsubtle. I've read accounts by Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who is a Kenyan writer, and he describes how his mother tongue is Kikuyu, but then in school, going to school in colonial Kenya, same thing, they would get punished and everybody would be told that they have to communicate either in Kiswahili or in English or else, right? So there's always been, or there is a culture of this political structure that wants to control the language to some extent that you use. Then moving into building for Kiswahili in particular, I will say that my work did not begin with Kiswahili. At least my journey in speech recognition did not begin with Kiswahili. With my interest in NLP, I've become acquainted and involved with Masakane. And Masakane is an organization that's building for African NLP and trying to advance or ensure its inclusion in academic research. And you find that the organization is largely composed of researchers or students who are based in Africa. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to Masakane project, it's interesting to see that typically people will want to build for the languages that are closest to them. And closest to them typically means either it's a language they speak or it's a language, maybe it's their mother tongue, or it may be a language that the community adjacent to them speaks, right? So it's hardly ever about what data sets exists for this task or, I don't know. That's the first one that comes to mind because it's what I imagine a researcher in a first world context makes a decision of what languages to include based on, right? If I'm doing the task of speech recognition, what data sets exist? And if a Kiswahili one exists, sure, it gets included. But if it doesn't exist, then okay, we're not going to have Kiswahili. And so we're trying to undo the compounded effect of African languages not being included at dataset development, at model development, at every single level. So when I first started working on speech recognition, actually started with Luya, the Luya languages, and these are languages spoken in parts of Western Kenya and Eastern Uganda. There are a group of languages, 18 maybe more in total. And the communities are actually called Luya because of political reasons. It was convenient at some point in Kenya's political history for these people to come together and be one tribe. But then essentially each of the 18 or 19 dialects is a different language, and some of them are as different from each other as day and night. So my interest began with Luya, largely because of proximity to me and it being a language that I care about, but then shifted to Kiswahili, largely because of my role at Mozilla, which is not to say that I'm not interested in Kiswahili, but then through it, I'm learning a whole other dynamic where language is concerned, which I would say is complementary to what I had already begun with my exploration of building for the Luya languages. So again, moving into Kiswahili, you realize that Kiswahili is not just one language. And actually, I wonder if this is how Western languages are structured, because why do we build for languages as if they exist as individual entities on their own? But Kiswahili is a language that belongs in a language family and has 23 plus related dialects, mm-hmm. right? And the Kiswahili, which we know today as standardized Kiswahili, is actually one of those 23 dialects. The question of which dialects to select for standardization is also a super interesting topic, which if you read into pre-colonial and colonial East Africa, you can learn more about. But because exploration of East Africa started with traders, Arab traders, Indian traders, and then came the missionaries who settled down and started evangelizing. And how do they do that? They start by learning the local language. So they found Kiswahili was in use along the coast and then started learning Kiswahili. Then when the move to standardized Kiswahili came, it was actually largely a debate between, I think, German missionaries and British missionaries. And so the Germans wanted the dialect which was spoken in the areas where they were settled to be the one that standardized, and the British wanted the same on their end. And it was all for, I'll say, selfish reasons, because each of them wanted the dialect that they were most familiar with to be the one selected for standardization. In the entire process, locals were not involved. So the dialect that was chosen for standardization, its reasons for selection had very little to do with its linguistic qualities as a language. And in fact, we see that through the process of standardization, a lot had to be done to complement the language as was, in terms of adding vocabulary and enriching it. And locals will actually tell you that the Kiswahili that emerged after standardization versus the dialect that was selected for standardization, locals actually consider that two different languages. And when I say locals, I mean individuals who speak Kiswahili as their mother tongue, right? Mm-hmm. So with building for Kiswahili, we started digging, and this history makes you realize that if we build for Kiswahili as we know it as standard Kiswahili, in my opinion, we'd be building the way the rest of the world has built for English. And it's this status quo that has resulted in what we know as underrepresented or low resource languages, right? Because if we focused on standard Kiswahili, it would mean it's coming at the expense of all the other 23 plus related dialects of Kiswahili, which have already been to a great extent marginalized and sidelined. You'll find that native speakers of Kiswahili's related dialects now are born in a home and interact in their native dialects. Let's take one as an example. Let's take Kimvita, which is spoken in Mombasa, right? So it's possible that a speaker of Kimvita will grow up and use it to interact in their home, in their household. But then when they do get to the point where they're going to school, the standard Kiswahili, which they'll be taught as a subject, is going to be deemed correct, right? They'll repeatedly end up in this situation where they're told, okay, what you're saying is not correct. The correct is actually X, or what you're saying is not correct. The correct is actually Y. But then the truth is it's more complex. But then regardless of what is considered correct or what's the history behind the current status quo is, the result is that there are Kiswahili dialects that are on the brink of dying, extinction, that are falling from disuse every day. And that's coming at the expense of what we know as standard Kiswahili, essentially. And again, I'm going to draw parallels to how we have how we have internationally built for English and other major Western languages at the expense of others. But I'll say that is the power of language, that you can actually wipe out a people or you can validate their existence. Touching a bit on vocabulary, I think that language carries values, it carries history, it carries culture. So in the task of data set creation, I think I would say it's much better to talk to writers or archaeologists or anthropologists and use language to document stories of our people versus taking texts written in a different language and then translating them into, say, Kiswahili, because we're looking to create Kiswahili texts. And it's the same way we should think critically about the development of AI technologies. I know right now pre-training and transfer learning is of great interest because it means we may not need to build as big data sets for all the languages. We can rely off of all the existing data currently for English and potentially start building speech recognition technologies for Kiswahili using that as a pre-trained model. But then we should think critically about the fact that the model pre-trained on English then has values or a culture or a history of the people who have wielded the language in their activities, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be ideas of capitalism or dictatorship or democracy that are embedded in those models that we're now imposing on a different people whose values absolutely get sidelined. And then thinking about more contemporary use of language, what happens when all the knowledge of creating AI models exists only in English? What then are we telling Kiswahili speakers? I think it's powerful signaling. It's telling them, number one, hey, these tools are not for you, except we do have the ability to translate them so that you can use them, but only at our convenience. Two, I think it's signaling that is potentially telling anybody who speaks these languages or does not speak English that, hey, actually the development of these tools is not a space is not a space that you should be playing in. Because why don't we stop and take the time to create this new terminology in different languages, and translate this information so that we actually make it accessible in different languages. So it's also very powerful signaling as to who we want in the room and what roles we want them to play, and how much we are giving versus how much we are taking. I've gone around a lot. I'll hand over the mic back to you.
No, it's perfect. That's actually a perfect segue into where we're going to go next. And that's going to be in our next segment where we're going to expand on this implication of language and in the tech space, especially what that ends up signaling on who these things are for. So stick with us on Worldbeat. We will be right back. Back to World Beat. I am George Collins, and to remind you, we are talking with Kathleen Semenyu. And so, Kathleen, we left off on the last segment, not just talking about the power of language, but the implications over who audiences are or who target audiences are in terms of things like development. And I think with science and technology in particular, that's a really interesting one. And I remember there was an article in Nature from August of 2021 that you contributed to that led with a quote, and this is referring to the Zulu folks down in southern Africa, quote, "There's no original isiZulu word for dinosaur. Germs are called," I'm not going to say this right, I apologize, folks, but germs are called amagewane, "but there are no separate words for viruses or bacteria. A quark is Ikwaki. There is no term for redshift, though. And researchers and science communicators using the language, which is spoken by more than 14 million people in southern Africa, struggle to agree on words for evolution. Now, isiZulu is one of approximately 2,000 languages spoken on the African continent, and modern science has ignored the overwhelming majority of these languages, although now a team of researchers from Africa wants to change that." And I remember you specifically saying in that article that African languages are being left behind in this online revolution. So there's a couple of directions that I think of with that, and you've started to touch on a couple of them. But to start with, when it comes to just science education, whether that's in school at the elementary level all the way up through the collegiate level, What does the lack of just even fundamental vocabulary, things that folks in, say, North America and Europe would take for granted that, you know, we've got just a single word for this, what impact does that have on the ability for science education to really flourish in countries like this?
I think it reinforces the notion that you need to learn a major Western language if you want to work in science or in other such niche fields. Because I can communicate very adequately in Kiswahili if I'm going to the market to buy food or if I'm going to the hospital and need assistance. I can say, "Hey, can I see a doctor? My stomach is aching." Or I can say, "Hey, give me those tomatoes. They look riper than the other ones." But then I can't walk into computer science class and start giving a lecture about speech recognition in Kiswahili, because even I don't know the vocabulary. And so it reinforces and emphasizes that, hey, if you want that upward mobility, then you actually have to, for the better part, conform and learn English or learn French or whatever language it is in that context. So with being left behind, I think it's Vukosi Marivate, and he's a researcher from South Africa, who said that we're probably at an inflection point where if machines don't know your language, then it's very possible that your language is going to be extinct in a certain number of years. And I sometimes think that we as techies sort of overstate the impact of technology, but then I think that's very true, because we're now seeing a greater reliance on digital platforms. Computers are really taking over very many varied aspects of our lives. And that means that not only will I need to learn English to participate, but then to survive. It becomes a question of survival. And it also becomes a tool through which we kill other languages, because I hardly think a future exists where people say, for example, speak only Kiswahili and therefore are not able to use computers or use mobile phones. I think it's much more plausible that a future exists where Kiswahili is no longer spoken and we've all drifted towards mainly using only English and then can access all these other platforms. I read an article also maybe a year or two back speaking about accents, because accent recognition is also a very key aspect to access, especially access to applications that are voice enabled. And the article was speaking about the fact that Google now has a Nigerian accent voice for various applications. So I know that on Maps, whenever I use Maps, the lady that's giving me directions is speaking in a Nigerian accent and I love it. And so the article was talking about the fact that was describing a scenario where a couple of guys might be sitting, having drinks, friends, talking, laughing. And then one of them says, "Hey, actually, I wonder what the weather is like today in Kilifi." And so it takes out their phone. But then when interacting with their voice assistant, they switch to an American accent. And it comes very naturally, very instinctively, because they realize that if they sounded like themselves, the voice assistant is not going to understand what they're saying. And so they very quickly learn to adapt and change how it is they are, so they are able to be understood. And I think this can be compared to facial recognition, right? Because facial recognition systems could give you access to a room. But if performance is better for a white man than it is for me, a black woman, then he's more likely to always get access whenever he's walking in versus me. But I think facial recognition is of much more urgency, because I can't fake being a white man so that recognition is better for me, right? If the system is unable to recognize my face as me, it means I'm not accessing that room. But if it's in the case of a voice assistant and the system is not able to understand me as myself, a black woman, if I can adapt my voice to sound like, you know, white male or whatever demographic, is going to be much better understood. And I think it's again an example of how diversity is increasingly being flattened for access to various systems. We cannot come onto the internet and interact with Swahili, so we have to sort of, you know, get rid of that diversity and conform. And what's the conforming language? English. And I'll say many things are being left behind. If we take it back to the conversation about culture and history, we're almost being forced to forget everything that makes us us, for us to sort of get access to these things which are supposed to be future facing and forward leaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to that point, I don't know if you're familiar with the American sociologist Ruha Benjamin. She wrote this great book from I think 2019 is when it was published, called Race After Technology, and mm-hmm. she explores a lot of these themes. Strictly in the American context, about looking at technology is always hyped up as this way of the future, right? Especially in you know, what we think of as the Web 2 era, where there was all of this forward look. Well, you mentioned The Social Network, that film earlier, which really seems to capture that zeitgeist of that era, that Facebook and all of these tech companies were going to lead us into these new horizons that we could just never imagine. No, mm-hmm. that at least stateside, that seems to have dampened a little bit in the wake of 2016 and the political role that a lot of those companies ended up assuming. But Benjamin's point is that all that talk is great for the people who are in control of these mechanisms and who are actually steering the ship. And that, you know, you talk about facial recognition. She also uses the example of sensors on hand sanitizer, that there were a lot of them that can't sense black skin tone because of the way that they're designed, or even just something like on Google Maps. There's a tweet that went out. I can't remember who wrote it, where it says that, hey, my GPS just told me to turn onto Malcolm 10 Road. and that guy says, at that point, I knew there was not a single black programmer in that room, because how the hell were you going to miss a detail like that? And then even on the subject of language, you know, I think about even something as simple as Google Translate, right? Which may have a Swahili option, but at least last time I checked, there's no Kamba. You know, there's no Luo, yeah. You know, there's nothing like that. And so if you're someone who wanted to learn that, you know, let's say that you didn't grow up hearing it or whatever, what's your mechanism for it in this supposedly endless space that we're told about? And what does that do for identity in an increasingly globalized world for people on the African continent? Because one of the things that I've found in my own report and in places like Kenya is that there can sometimes be this sense of, I'm not sure what the word would be for it, perhaps ennui in a way, where there can almost be a sense of, like, the rest of the world is not for us. Like, there's a whole world moving out there, and almost by design, we can't seem to participate in it even if we want to, either because on a practical level, our institutions don't work, or everything that you're talking about right here. And so when it comes to the idea of, like, self-determination or a lot of these you know, development goals that we hear about, how do these barriers impact that, and what kinds of challenges does that present in all these goals that, you know, governments or whomever want to advance?
Okay, so let me start at identity. I think that identity is very contextual, and it's absolutely absurd that our identity can, at the international platform or on a global level, be perceived as what is understood as identity in one context. And to try and explain that, let me tell you a bit of a story. When I was 19, just after finishing high school, I spent 3 months in Australia. I was working on an exchange project. And it was the first time in my life that I was in an environment where, as an African, I was the minority, right? Having been born and bred in Kenya and essentially lived here for majority of 19 years of my life, and then landed in Australia, in Sydney, in a very suburban neighborhood where me and my other, my fellow Kenyan who traveled with me were literally the two black people for a while. And this is actually where I realized I was black. And, you know, with, I'll say Africans, at least people who've grown up in Africa, this is something that we can talk about. And it's a recognizable shared experience, the time at which you realized you were black. And I say this again because I've grown up in a majority African environment where I wasn't black. I was Luya. I was many other things. There were very many other labels that were put on me to define my identity, and none of them was ever black. But then the moment I landed on a different continent, none of that mattered. What mattered was I was black, largely because of the sociopolitics of the world and who is dictating the identity that we all then don. And then last Christmas, I spent some time with my dad, and we got to talking about his professional experience being someone who's worked in the government of Kenya for literally his whole career, let's say it's 30 years. And he narrated to me experiences of tribalism, where he applied for a job, was shortlisted, three people made the shortlist, and then the person who gets awarded the job is not even someone who was on the application roster for the role. It's someone who is of the tribe or ethnicity of whoever is awarding the role. So he speaks of a professional experience where his identity and his ethnic identity in particular has heavily played a role in whether he accessed some things versus did not access some things, whether he was on the right side of the government or the other side of the government. And this is very different from my professional experiences where, again, it's the same as when I went to Australia for the first time. I close this laptop and then, you know, I'm just Kathleen. I'm a Luya girl living in the coast in Kilifi, which is, you know, not where my people are from, but then it's a certain identity. But then the moment I open this laptop, then I'm a Black woman working in AI who's based in Kilifi in Kenya. And it's absurd. It's laughable, but then it's part of what digital platforms make possible. It makes possible that I'm able to evade the ethnic political dynamics of being who I am in Kenya in a professional workspace. But then it also means that when I get onto the internet, I sort of have to contend with who I am on the internet. And all that is a Black woman, right? It's an identity that's born of a very Western context that has little to do with me, except everything to do with me because I interact on digital platforms. So I realized that it is making possible new realities, which are both good and bad. I'm a huge believer in decentralized AI being the correct way to build AI, right? Because again, I'll go back to the first thing I said, which is that identity can be very contextual. So why should I be submitted to my identity based on a Western context when I don't live there, I'm not from there, my lived realities are actually very different? Why can't my identity be much more localized? And from an AI perspective, I think that needs to mean that we give communities much more autonomy when it comes to building for themselves. Something I would love to see is for us to build much more decentralized AI and no longer leave it to big tech, but to rather empower local communities. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know if it's driven through government or regional bodies. I don't know what it looks like, but then I think communities are a great way to go. I've seen great models of community-run organizations through the tech and developer communities on the continent. And again, I've seen that evolved from capacity-building measures to a point where, with the deep learning in Daba, for example, one of the programs which we have is known as the Indaba X, where we empower national communities at country level to have Indaba-like events every year. And in the first year we ran that program, I think there were maybe 11 Indaba Xs. And then in the next year we had that program, it had grown to something like 23 Indaba Xs. And each Indaba X represents a country that has enough capacity, has a team that is able to, you know, step up and say, we want to host an Indaba X and go ahead and do that. We've gone from a point of capacity building to a place where we now have critical mass. There's more than 30 countries on the African continent that now have active AI communities. And a good data point for this is the fact that they're able to hold Indaba X's. And then what comes next, or what came next, is then a need for much more specialized capacity building. And this is something that we've also seen evolved in the Indabas, because we started out having a poster session, which was optional, actually. So every attendee to an Indaba could present a poster if they wanted to, or if they had work that they thought they could present as a poster. And this evolved, this space evolved. And in 1 year in particular, I think it was 2019, actually, the 2019 Indaba was in Nairobi. And at that Indaba, there were so many papers on machine translation, or generally NLP for African languages. And I think the reason why, again, it goes back to the fact that once we have basic skills, everybody is most likely to start working on the problems that are closest to them as an individual. It may be close in proximity, it may be close for sentimental reasons, but then comes the need for specialized capacity building, because we then start to identify problems in our ecosystem, which are sort of low-hanging fruit, and then converge around the biggest things. NLP is one of those things. I've also seen a community grow for computer vision, particularly in agriculture. So there's very many groups of researchers now doing image or crop classification for rice, for cassava, for maize. But we've seen that specialized capacity building, and that has grown to much more access to funding, because people are now able to write or put together project proposals, have a credible number of partners that they can list, as well as experience, and then, you know, get funding to carry out some of these projects. I do think one huge challenge to actually getting to community-driven AI is compute, because even if we did somehow manage to break down the behemoths that are big tech, I don't know that we'd be able to figure out a way for these local communities to have access to compute. And even in the work that I've done with these communities, I see that as repeatedly a stumbling block. We'll have teams come together, put together a proposal, get funding, and then realize that A, they didn't allocate enough to compute, or B, they simply did not think that compute would be that huge a deal, but then now need access to some compute. So we have to start looking for cloud credits or something for them to continue their work. And this is a very different reality from someone who sits at a Western institution and sort of just has access to timeshare compute, which they can use for all their work, right? So I think compute is
a huge stumbling block. Just to clarify what you mean by that, do you mean like the like infrastructure to support like physical computers and machines that are accessible, or what kind of support are you referring to there?
Not necessarily physical infrastructure, but compute to train ML models. It could be in the cloud. It could be that you have a physical GPU on your laptop. But then we do have a huge need for compute. In Masakane, for example, we largely use GCP. And that's because our relationships with individuals at Google has meant that it's very easy for us to say, hey, here's a project. Are you able to give them cloud credits for, you know, X period of time to run the experiments? So we've been able to survive on goodwill in that case. But then I do think about the fact that if you think about the case of OpenAI and their language model and the amount of compute that goes into building that versus, you know, the cloud credits that we use to build the models that we do, it's almost incomparable that we're supposed to be competing in the same field and building the same tools.
It seems to me, if I could just think, because when I was an undergrad, I studied economic development on the African continent with a public health focus in particular. But really, I think this principle could apply, that there seems to have long been this idea that of, like, say, a global, like, free market, right? Which is a loaded term. No one seems to know what that means anymore. But at least in this context, it's often taken to mean that if trade is just opened up across all countries of the world, that this is the path to prosperity. And what we figured out pretty quick was that, yeah, sure, maybe on paper that works, but paper's also a thin thing that goes all greasy when you rub, or goes all see-through when you rub grease on it, right? And that for that philosophy to succeed, all of these countries would have to be on an even playing field. And the reality is they just weren't at the time, and certainly throughout a lot of those projects. And from what you're describing, it sounds like it's a trap that can easily be fallen into in this tech space too, that tech is seen as this egalitarian space. Everyone has access. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, yeah, on paper, that might be the design, but is that the reality? And, you know, those things seem to be distant cousins that ain't always on speaking terms, if you will.
Yeah.
And so it really seems like a repetition of some of those mistakes of the past when it comes to the idea of, well, what constitutes the path forward to development for a lot of nations.
I completely agree. And it actually brings me to the next thing I wanted to say, which is access to data, right? Because there's not much data available that speaks to an African context, for example, but then there's much more if you compare it to a Western context. So it means that we also have much less data to innovate or build solutions for our context. But we now have a lot more funders directing their funding to data sets about local African contexts, right? And I find it very interesting that the wording, it's always painted as an effort that is going to be very beneficial to us as the locals, right? Because the data sets existing means that it's that much easier for the development of AI tools, which could vastly change our realities. But then we never talk about who's going to build those AI tools, because there's not as much funding or as much effort being put into ensuring that the upskilling activities are continuing in tandem to the data set building, such that when the data set is ready, the local populations are actually the ones who are able to take the data sets and use them to build for our context, right? It's again a half-told story, because the reality is that as soon as the data set exists, it's much easier for someone seated in a much more privileged context to take the data set, quickly build a solution, and then come back and sell it to us, which is unfair.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely want to expand on that and some of the paths forward that we're going to be seeing. That's where we're going to head in our next segment. Stick with us on Worldbeat. We'll be right back.